Okay, so first let me say thanks to the organizers for the chance to come here and talk to you and interact with all of you and give a talk on some of my work. And since I guess this is the last talk, maybe we should all thank the organizers for putting all this together. Yeah. And okay, so what will I be telling you about today? So as Bobby mentioned, I'll be telling you about F-theory and spin 7 manifolds. So as a general disclaimer, I will say that both the physics and the math of this is rather new, and so I will try to explain what we think we understand and what kind of questions I have, at least, for understanding some aspects of this. So this is based on two papers, which appeared on the preprint archive, one from last year and one from this year. And there's stuff in progress, which I will probably not talk about. And it's with a set of postdocs at UPenn. So this is Craig Lowry, Ling Lin, and Gianluca Zoccarato, and then same set of people, and also Jeremy Sackstein. So in this one, we kind of laid out the main mathematical proposal, and in this one, we talked more about the cosmology. There is still some interesting geometry to be said here, which I'll try to touch on, but those are the main pieces. Okay, so what have been some applications of spin 7 in the context of physics in the past? So kind of the classic example involves M-theory, which is some 11-dimensional theory, at least macroscopically. And spin 7 is some 8-manifold, and so you get out a 3-dimensional theory with minimal supersymmetry. And so you can study some very interesting aspects of this. I'll be talking about, I will come back to M-theory kind of in the, hopefully the second half of the talk. But so what is F-theory? So it involves a 10-dimensional space-time. And we're going to be looking at 4-dimensional physics that we get out from this. Now, your first question might be, well, how did I get from 10 to 4 if a spin 7 manifold has eight dimensions? And the point is that the way we formulate F-theory involves talking about a 12-dimensional auxiliary geometry, and it's really that thing that we're using to get down to 4 dimensions. So historically, when you talk about compactifying F-theory, usually people specialize to the case of elliptically fibered Calabi-Yau manifolds of various dimensions. And this is because it's fairly well posed in the context of extracting 4-dimensional physics, or in other cases, 6D physics, and so on. What I'll be trying to tell you about is some of the kind of a different physical interpretation for what is going on in the context of spin 7. So what is one of the physics schools here? physics school. Cosmology. And the size of the universe, if you like. So I'm not going to talk too much about this, but the essential idea is that we imagine that we have a 4D space-time. And what I'll be telling you about is that these kinds of spin 7 geometries generate, so these are pseudo-Riemannian, they have a time-like direction. And something like this. This is a metric on a three-sphere, a round metric on a three-sphere. And there's a thing called the scale factor, which controls the size of that three-sphere. And in the models that we can actually generate, the idea is that there is the scale factor, and it's expanding and becoming very, very big.
So
so
the
there's a very mild version of supersymmetry showing up, which I'll try to explain. So that's actually one of the conceptual points, which is rather new on the physics side. And so I will try to get to that, but I will get to it. What else can I tell you here? Related to this is a general physics question related in a similar spirit to things that Gordy was asking about. It involves hierarchies of scales. So in particular, why is the universe so big? So if you look at the quantum theories that we have and you try and calculate the size of the universe after you take into account quantum corrections, in the absence of things like supersymmetry, it's typically the case that it looks, unless you do a lot of tuning with the parameters of the geometry, very, very small. and so as was recognized a long time ago when these things were first kind of discussed in some vague terms, considering F-theory on spin 7 might help with addressing why the universe gets to be so big. So this is sometimes referred to as the cosmological constant problem. Okay, so I promise I will tell you about some geometric things soon. Okay, so since since I'm going to be telling you about things to do with F-theory, I should tell you a little bit more about F-theory. Dave already gave you a nice 5-minute interview. I will give you not too much more, but you know, a little bit more, hopefully enough that you'll be able to follow what I'm talking about. So we're talking about string theory, and so we're talking about a 10-dimensional space-time. So I'll formulate it by talking about type 2B strings. The various things like 2s and Bs have to do with how many spinner representations you have for the supercharges and what the irreducible representations you have for those spinners. So that's this is a particular choice. This is the one I'm going to be talking about. Now, in type 2B string theory, you have a parameter, which Dave also mentioned, this parameter tau, called the axioskeleton. This is just a field in your physical theory. So you have, of course, the metric. But in addition to that, so that's the metric. But in addition, you have this axiodilaton, and you can split it up into a real and imaginary part. It takes values in the upper half plane. and the physical theory at least enjoys a redundancy under the following transformations, fractional linear transformations, for A, B, C, D, and SL, 2, Z. in addition to this, as Dave already mentioned, there's another set of degrees of freedom, which are important, which involve a pair of two forms. Let me call them I'm not being very imaginative today, B1 and B2. And they transform as a doublet in the expected way under. These will actually play an important role in what I'm going to tell you. So B1 and B2 being sent to that. OK, so in F theory, so please stop me if you have any questions. OK, so now. Yes, sorry. So BI is a two-form. And I will often talk about the corresponding field strength generated by these, which locally can be presented as HI equals DB, a three-form. And one of these is called the Neve-Schwarz, or NS, two-form, and the other one is called the Ramond. The names are not important, at least not yet. Okay, so in F theory, what do we do? in F theory, we interpret tau as the complex structure of an elliptic curve. So inside of a weighted projective space, inside of like, you'd write something like inside P2, and then maybe 1, 2, 3, with suitable weights for each of these things, so that my thing makes sense as a homogeneous equation. Okay, so tau is the complex structure of an elliptic curve. The nice feature of this is that the redundancy of this is automatically encoded now geometrically. So rather than me talk about this particular physical parameter, I will instead talk about things more geometrically. So that will allow me to say things more cleanly, hopefully. Okay, so this tau, because it is a physical theory, is allowed to depend on the 10 space-time directions that we're talking about. So what we're going to be talking about is really some elliptic curve. Here's my elliptic curve. And there will be some base. And we allow this tau to vary as we move around on the base. And it could degenerate in various ways at, you know, different places on the geometry. So the name of the game, typically, in F theory, is to talk about elliptically fired geometries. So in F theory. Okay. Now, where do things like Ricci flatness and so on come into the game? So in terms of the a typical thing we will often do is factor this now 12-dimensional geometry, 10 physical space-time plus the two auxiliary from the torus. We will split them up as something I will call a macroscopic set of directions and a microscopic set of dimensions. So the physical space-time will live on the big dimensions. And so that will have dimension d minus 1, comma 1. I'm indicating that there's a single time direction, so it's not quite a Riemannian manifold. And over here, when we talk about F theory, we'll talk about so the physical space-time will have whatever this is, 10 minus d. But then the total space will be 12 minus d. So for example, if I'm talking about a four-dimensional theory, then I want to talk about a particular choice of eight manifold that I'm going to talk about for my F theory background. Okay. No, I think I have it right. So I add this plus this, and I get d.
Yes.
And then I add d again to that, and so this whole thing is 10-dimensional. Correct. And so this would have signature 9, 1 as a space-time, if I write down the metric for the thing. And then if I also append to it this auxiliary 2 torus, which is, again, telling me about this data of tau, the shape of this 2 torus, then I have this sort of thing. More questions? So if all I talk about is F theory, that's fine with me. More questions? Okay, so what is kind of the classic paradigm that people use in this context? Okay. So the classic paradigm involves specializing to cases of special holonomy, and kind of the canonical set of examples involve Calabi-Yau, elliptically fibered Calabi-Yau spaces. Now, why is that? So when we write down the full set of physical equations that we're trying to satisfy, these involve the so-called Einstein field equations, but with certain types of sources added in. So So in 10D, what are you trying to solve? The Einstein field equations. Plus sources. Would you like me to write those equations? Or is it? Okay. So this is what we mean by the sources, often called sources of stress energy. This is all stuff built purely from the metric. And the very clever thing about F-theory is that when you talk about in terms of 12 dimensions, a lot of this stuff, at least if you pick the configurations you're talking about appropriately, reduces to saying something like, I would like, M 10 minus D to have special home. Just write that special holonomy. 12D. So that's the total space for the internal piece. Thank you very much. Yeah, that's right. Thanks. So that's the very clever thing about F theory. And so the practical benefit of this is that this is a nightmare to solve just directly, but it becomes much simpler if we just try and find elliptically fibered, you know, Calabi-Yau spaces. So the main thing that people have focused on is in Calabi-Yau geometries. Of course, I'm not going to talk about that. I will touch on it, but I'm going to try and extend this to spin 7, for example. Yes. So from a physical point of view, there's a very good reason to also pick. So it would be Calabi-Yau fourfolds. So and it has to do with the amount of supersymmetry you retain in the four-dimensional theory. So it's a minimal amount of supersymmetry, and so if you think like I do, and I think other people do, that supersymmetry isn't too far away, then a good approximation, if you're talking about things at higher scales, would look approximately supersymmetric once you get to those higher energies, and therefore you'd be interested in F-theory on things like Calabi-Yau fourfolds. So, in fact, what I want to tell you about now is how we count the supersymmetries for these systems. So this is kind of, so what I've told you so far is kind of the standard story, but now I'm about to deviate from it in a few ways. So how am I going to deviate from it? So I want to count the amount of supersymmetry that we get from considering whatever special holonomy manifold I have right over here. Okay. So as I said, I have this macroscopic dimension and I have this microscopic dimension. Here's how I'm going to count it. I'm going to do something which I'm first going to consider. Spinners on the following geometry. So, by the way, I should say that typically, this thing is taken to be flat space, so Minkowski space, or something that looks like R d minus 1, comma 1, as a, if I also signal out which is the time direction. So I'm not going to quite do that. I'm instead going to consider something that has signature d minus 2, comma 2, and I'm going to keep these things as they are. So we'll still get this product, 10 minus d, and the total space over this will be 12 minus d dimension. Okay. Now, I'll explain why I'm doing this. It makes it actually much more convenient to count the supercharges when we do this. So you'll notice now that the signature of my space, whatever it may be, looks like 10 comma 2. So essentially what we're going to do is we're going to be looking at spinners on this. And we're going to ask how those spinners break up as we consider them on this part here and this part here. So I'm going to be considering a spinner in 12D, or more precisely in 10, 2 signature, and I will split it. Now let me again just specialize to the case of D equals 4. So I'll split it into a spinner. Oh, let's use a different name. chi and psi? I don't know. So we can make a sum like this, chi and psi, and then we'll maybe sum over them. Okay, so in terms of this, we first need to ask what is the minimal dimensional representation we can write down in 10,2 signature. Now, because you have these two time directions, you can actually impose various conditions to lower the dimension of the... So I remind you, well, you guys probably know this better than I do. If you start with SOP, Q with, spin P, Q with P minus Q congruent to 0 mod 8, then you can impose simultaneously several conditions on what would have been the Dirac spinner. So you can impose simultaneously, I don't even know the math name for this, the Majorana condition and a Weyl condition. So this is what I would have called a chirality condition. And this is what I would have called a reality condition. When you do that, you discover that the dimension of this spinner representation is, or the minimal representation, is 32. And I will write it as 32MW to remind me that I imposed two conditions, a reality condition and a chirality condition. So typically, I will not even bother writing things out like this. I'll just tell you what representation I'm talking about by labeling its dimension. And if I ever encounter ambiguities, I will put a prime on it or something like that. Okay, so let's consider the case where we split it into SO2, 2. So I haven't specialized a special holonomy yet. I'm just talking about what I would do to just decompose this thing. And what do you get for the representations? There's two distinct two-dimensional representations we can write down here, because this thing is isomorphic to SL2R cross SL2R. And you might label them as a left copy and a right copy. So I will do the same thing here. I write a 2 left to indicate that it's under this one. And then there's the corresponding, there's 3 eight-dimensional representations. I will pick the one that's associated with a spinner plus another one, R. I said I was going to use primes. I guess I should stick to that, although spinner prime. There you go. Okay, so you can see that there's a 32-dimensional thing right here, and it splits up as 16 here. These are all real things. 2 times 8 is 16, and I have another 16 coming from here.
Spin
4, 2? Yeah, so I'm talking about in four total dimensions, 2 of which are time-like and 2 of which are spatial. Yeah. Does that answer the...
No, yeah.
Okay. Yeah, so these have different chiralities on R8. That's right. So that's so yes, that's what I mean by chirality. More questions? Is it okay? Or so, for example, SO4 contains SU2 cross SU2 as a subalgebra. This is kind of the analytically continued version of that statement. It's just a two-component doublet. It's actually quite crucial that I have SL2R here rather than SU2, because if you look at how many... Is it okay? Okay. Yeah, so it's actually quite important for kind of the reality conditions that I'm able to impose. So again, because this thing has P minus Q equal to 0 mod 8, because of that, I can simultaneously impose a Majorana and Weyl condition. So I can produce something that has a two real-dimensional representation. To count the supersymmetries. So I'm going to now count the supersymmetries doing this. So I'm going to now say, suppose you specialize to your favorite special holonomy manifold. I would like to know how many supersymmetries are left over when I do Calabi-Yau 4-fold, 3-fold, and spin 7. So the point is that the standard way, at least I know, that you do this is you invoke some trick where you go down on a circle, et cetera, et cetera. You go to an M-theory limit and you say, let's count the supersymmetries there. Now, I am not going to do that here for a couple of reasons. Number one, I think it hides a bunch of things, and you should be able to intrinsically talk about things in F-theory without doing that. Another reason is that the space-time I'm going to talk about, at least when I go back to 3, 1 signature, is going to have topology R cross S3. Now, there is a circle here, which if I were giving a physics talk, I would talk more about. So there is a circle bundle there, and you can perform an M-theory reduction, but it loses some of the physics when you perform that reduction. So I find that discussion to be a bit more awkward than what I'm going to tell you about. There's some other things that come up in 2, 2 signature, which are kind of hard to spot if you work directly in 3, 1 from the start. So that's so I'll try to kind of mention that and say that's the other reason why this. It's much, yeah. Correct. That's right. So the other point is that when you actually look at the Killing Spinner equations and you ask how many supersymmetries you preserve, if you're in 2, 2 signature, you see one answer, and when we continue back to 3, 1, you will see a different answer. So the point is that even though in 3, 1 it will look like supersymmetry is totally broken, there's some faint remnant of it showing up because in 2, 2, it turns out that there is a symmetry enhancement. So in other words, it's not just some random generic 8 manifold. Yes, please. So we're going to have fluxes through this thing right here.
But I'm asking about the other sink dimension. So are they assumed to be compact?
Yeah. I can take both compact and non-compact. So I will. So in this first half, how much time do I have, by the way? Or about half an hour, right? Okay, great. Okay, great. Well, I'm the last talk, so I can just trail on forever, right? Or, oh, okay. Okay. Not like a vineyard tour or anything. No vineyard tours. Or... Okay, never mind. All right, so... right, he got on a plane. Okay. Yeah, so let's keep going. So now let's consider the various kinds of special holonomy manifolds of interest to us. So the cases I'll consider are kind of the classic ones that look like Calabi-Yau spaces, and then I'll ask how spin 7 fits into that set. where am I? So let me write down spin 7, SU4 for the Calabi-Yau four-fold case. I suppose I should write SU3 cross whatever. Won't matter too much. Oh, sure. Sure, we could do that one. I won't, but yes, we could do it. Yeah. I just want to give you a flavor of how it goes. I'm not actually going to talk about it. That would be like, say, if we were on a K3 or things like that. Or I'm not going to talk about those for right now. Just to give you an idea. So how many supersymmetries do you get when you do this? So if we look at, so these are all inside of spin 8 for me. So I'll look at how 8s and how 8s prime break up. Again, this is something you guys know way better than I do, so I don't know why I'm telling you about it. So again, when I write a number, it means I'm telling you just the dimension of the representation. And in this case, what do you get? You get 8. S goes to 3 plus 3 bar. I'm not even bothering with the U1. plus 1 plus 1. OK, so now let's start counting all of the supersymmetries. So the way we mean when we say the number of Qs is we say, look at dimension of our spinner on M, well, in this case, 2, 2 macro. So the big physical spacetime where we imagine physics is taking place. OK, so how many do you have in each of these cases? You have 2, you have 4, and you have 8. How did I get to 2? I said, well, I have 1 from here, nothing from here. I multiply by 2, and that's how I got to my 2. Okay. Do the same thing here and here. So I get to 4, and I get to 8. Okay. Now, when you analytically continue back, so from 2, 2, back to 3, 1, what would this thing correspond to? It's what we would often call a 4-dimensional n equals 2 theory. This one we would call a 4-dimensional n equals 1 theory. And this is what we typically call the minimal, or it is the minimal amount of supersymmetry. How are we to make sense of this thing here? So if we risk kind of being quite loose, I'll put this in quotes, 4d n equals 1/2. There is no such thing as a 4d n equals half subalgebra in 3, 1 signature. It would only make sense if we stayed in 2, 2 signature. So I'm supposed to be giving a math thing, but you know, whatever. The physical interpretation of this is that we have, in our physical theory, a Hilbert space of states. And we commonly refer to these as things like that. And we can ask what happens when we track these over from 2, 2 signature to 3, 1 signature. And there's one particular state which you can define by analytic continuation across all the signatures, which is what is often referred to as the vacuum or the ground state. This is a privileged state. Such that the point is you can complexify your algebra in whatever way you please. This is a common trick. It often goes by the name of Bunch Davies. So by abuse of its notation, I'm going to use the same the same terminology. This thing can be continued from 2, 2 to 3, 1. And so in this sense, the ground state has some interesting properties, even in 3, 1 signature. That being said, if you looked at the partners, the superpartner spectrum or things like that from a physical point of view, it would not look supersymmetric. I won't talk about the scale of supersymmetry breaking. That's something we're working on in the question marks. But that's future work. OK, so now let's just take this as our starting point. What we would like to know is, can we make sense of? So now I'll start turning into the math parts. Can we make sense of F theory on spin 7? So one of the conditions I need, it sounds like I need, OK, do I need a T2 fibration over a base? This will be some real 6-dimensional base. So the total space is 8-dimensional. And I want the whole thing to be a spin 7 manifold. So a very fast physics argument would tell you, well, that must be impossible because there's no such thing as n equals half supersymmetry. Yes?
I looked at this kind of thing like some years ago. I didn't write a paper about it. But what I concluded was that if you take the, do the old way of going to M theory and then taking the F theory limit, you end up with a non Lorentz invariant four-dimensional theory that does have two supercharges, but it has two supercharges because the backgrounds are not Lorentz invariant.
Right. So one thing you can do, so you can do precisely that. It's not exactly what I'll do, but you could take that threesphere I had and introduce a squashing parameter. And when you introduce that squashing parameter, you kind of introduced a particular vector to point things along. And once you do that, then it's not in each individual frame, it looks like there's a particular vector, and then it would look like more like a 3D n equals 1 type of supersymmetry algebra. So that's along the lines of things you're talking about. And and historically, people did write papers. So prior to our stuff, there was German, Pugh, and Linetti, where they considered putting a four-dimensional theory on a finite interval. And the only way that makes sense is if you also introduce additional sources and things at the sides of the interval. Yeah. So for sure, that would look like you're violating.
They come from G plus.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I'm just mentioning what people did in the past. I'm not doing what they're doing.
Okay.
So I'm just saying, like, what did people try in the past? That's right. They assume Minkowski. And so the place where we're going to deviate the most from kind of the standard F3 lore is we're going to put a flux through the space-time. And this is going to loosen up all of the conditions people were complaining about. So another complaint you could have is, are you even sure that there is a T2 fibered spin 7 manifold? I'm not. I mean, I should ask you guys. My expectation would actually be probably not. But for sure it's not elliptic. The question is whether you even have T2 fibers. Now, based on what Andy and Socorro were telling us, in fact, I started thinking about this because of a talk one or two of them gave, like, you know, in 2018. They said they were talking about these generalized connected sums, and even if there might be some global problem defining the T2 fibration, it looks pretty good if you look at individual slices. And so almost everywhere, it looks like there might be a T2 fibration. Now, whether the thing can be globally completed, all right, I'm not going to get into that. But what I want to do is ask, is it so bad if there's places where the T2 fibration fails? So, as is common in physics, if something starts failing or something starts developing singularities, those are actually the most interesting places to be from a physics point of view. So I will not run away from the singularity. I will ask, what happens when I go towards it? Okay, so... more questions about where I'm heading. So since I'm running a little bit short on time, maybe I'll just tell you the physical proposal. The physical proposal has to do with the presence of this three-sphere, which we're going to thread by three-form flux. Now, when you do that, in the physical F-theory model, remember I told you that you had these two three-form potentials and they rotated as a doublet? If I tell you a preferential vector in that doublet, that means that I must have broken the SL2 somewhere. By broken, I mean that you simply do not have the SL2 redundancy anymore. What would that mean? That corresponds to putting an extra brain into the system. So on R cross S3, you take this three-form flux, and you get this n is an integer. By doing this, you destroy the T2 fibration somewhere. Can I be more specific? Sure. If you have these kind of solutions, a classic example of this in the physics literature is something I'll write like this in local patch. This is called the near horizon limit of an NS5 brain. I'm just telling you the name, but this is what you have. The properties of the solution are that H3, this integral I just told you about, is non-zero, and also that tau parameter I was telling you about has a non-trivial gradient. In fact, it goes like, I don't know why I'm doing it like this, it goes like 1 over n in suitable normalization units. Okay, so the idea is that I'm going to talk about a three-sphere. I can look at this thing and I can ask, where would I put these things in my F-theory geometry? So now I'm going to tell you about a general proposal for why we think that we can start manufacturing things that look very close to n equals half. We will consider for the n equals 1 F theory on, and that's just a Calabi fourfold. What I'm going to do is I'm going to split it up, and I'm going to try to tell you where I'm going to put these NS5 brains in the geometry such that I will, after smoothing the thing out suitably, generate something close to spin 7. Now again, I'm using spin 7 in the absolute weakest sense, namely, I just want something that has 2 supercharges and 2 comma 2 signature. Okay, so here's my Calabi-Yau. I'm going to split it into 2 pieces. A little piece over here that looks like locally, is it okay if I say dp9? Okay, great. dp9 over S, a Kähler surface. And what I will do is I will, of course, have to delete some component. So it's really some log Calabi-Yau. This I'll call the left part. And everything else out here is what I'll call the right part. There's a little region in here that's going to look like a Calabi-Yau threefold and then a cylinder like this. And I'm assuming that this is an elliptically fibered Calabi-Yau threefold. So let me write it more. In fact, if I build this correctly, it should look like this. So locally, where am I going to put the NS5 brain? I'm going to put it. So the 5 stands for 5 spatial. I want to put it over these directions and over the circle. So on S cross S1. Okay. So the point is that there's some direction, which I'm now calling X perp, along which there is a non-trivial profile for this thing here. So in other words, if you tried to analyze, where did I write it here? If I said, I would like to talk about an elliptically fibered spin 7 manifold, it may not quite work. What I'm going to do is I'm going to say, that's OK. There's some region like this. And along that X perp region, which I'm identifying, like that, this thing is non-zero. This is a condition that would not happen if we were talking about a Calabi-Yau fourfold. So in a Calabi-Yau fourfold, this thing would have been zero except at very small regions of the space. Do you have a question?
Yeah, I'm just trying to understand the picture. So what's it mean? Is the fourfold fibered by Calabi-Yau threefold?
No, just locally. So we're doing this thing where we take this asymptotic cylindrical limit, and we're saying, I take this thing and I cut out like a little local patch. This is where all the particle physics would go, for example. And then we have to glue that thing back into a compact geometry. So there's a family of metrics where I'm imagining that there's a tube like this. There are for sure concrete examples of that kind. So I could take like things that have like a total K3 fibration over something else. Those would be kind of the canonical examples, which would also have nice heterotic duals. However, this is a more general statement. So this is something that was talked about in a paper by Banagi, Katz, and Weinholt, where they say, let's build something over here, and then let's ask what happens, how it would kind of glue in.
So what is that over there?
This?
Yeah.
Oh, this thing looks locally like a Delpezzo 9 fibered over a Kähler surface, and then we chop out a Calabi-Yau threefold divisor from that thing so that it's a log Calabi-Yau, log Calabi-Yau fourfold. And then there's this tube-like region because of where I chopped it, and that's where I'm going to glue into the rest of this thing. So then there's this tubular region over here, which looks like Calabi-Yau threefold times cylinder. That Calabi-Yau threefold is itself elliptically fibered, and in that little local patch of the geometry, that building block there, is where I wish to place my NS5 brains. In this region. That's right. That's right. So in this cylinder, there's a nice circle for me to wrap things on. So, yeah. More questions? So the math question is, if we take like a Calabi-Yau fourfold, we stretch it out, can we kind of chop it and re-glue it such that, so take an elliptically fibered Calabi-Yau fourfold, chop it, re-glue it, and when you re-glue it, can you detect what happened with the T2 fibration? Namely, there should be some breakdown in it in some way. as dictated by this equation. Expectation is that this will, well, good enough for me, but not good enough for you probably, is this thing turning into a spin 7 manifold, which is almost T2 fibered. Doesn't have to be exactly T2 fibered, but just close enough.
So that is kind of true for all the known compact examples of spin 7 manifolds. So you can always, all the known examples as far as I'm aware, rigorously existing examples, you can think of them as starting with a Calabi-Yau four-fold, dividing by an anti-holomorphic involution,
right,
and then desingularizing.
That's right.
When you do that, if you look at the orbifold limit, if the Calabi-Yau four-fold we started with was elliptically fibered, the involution acts on each elliptic fiber as complex conjugation. So it acts with fixed points on the elliptic curves. So you have some, I don't know about the exact equation, but certainly the derivatives of the complex structure will be non-zero.
Exactly. So that's exactly why we think it's not totally crazy. Yeah.
You might also have a free action, by the way. Go up on that.
Yeah, but then that's not spin 7 holomorphic manifold.
Well, it's SU4 similar right there, too, but all he said is he wants to have those two superchargers, and they would also appear in that.
Yeah, so the question is how much you can smear the brain out, I think. I think that's the physics question I would ask, is how much you can smear the thing out. So from a physics point of view, I'll stick these NS5 brains in, and then I'll imagine that the thing back reacts. And by the time I'm done with it, I don't see any NS5s. The only thing I see is the flux through the three sphere. That's the fluxy remnant of the thing. And so by the time I'm done, there will be some kind of weird violation of holomorphic elliptic vibration. I don't think there's any doubt about that. Yeah, and then the question is, what's the physical interpretation of it? The case I can interpret for you is the case where I make things as, jammed up and as smooth on one side and smooth as one side, and I glue them as awkwardly as possible. That is not what you probably want to do from the perspective of constructing it, but what I'm telling you is the signature for this effect is that this thing is non-zero, whatever it may be. Okay, let me see. I think I told you everything about the global geometry. Let me just briefly talk a little bit about the local geometry. When am I supposed to stop? Am I supposed to stop now, or? Can I have like 5 minutes? Okay, thanks. So here all I've been telling you about is kind of the global picture. Now I want to tell you about some of the kind of machinery we're doing to analyze some aspects of the local geometry. And it's cleaner to state this not so much in F-theory, but in terms of M-theory. You can state it in F-theory, but I don't want to get into the physical subtleties here. So, so let's now talk about local geometries. And what I have in mind, so as I erase, the local geometries I'll be considering are manifolds of with ADE fibers, ADE singularity fibered over some manifold. So that manifold is going to be, for example, either a Riemann surface, complex curve. It could be a Kähler surface, real dimension 4. It could be a Kähler 3-fold. It could be a real 3-manifold, as Sakura and Miriam talked about. And it could also be just a real 4-manifold, meaning not a Kähler surface. So let me just quickly tell you what you get in each of these cases. So manifold, what's the choice? Okay, what do I have? I have a curve, I have a Kähler surface. So the subscript here means complex dimension for me. So maybe I'll write 1c, sorry for the poor notation. X3, some Kähler 3-fold, some 3-manifold, and some 4-manifold. So physicists like to do this kind of thing, and I hope that I can convey to you the kind of general pattern of things we're doing in this kind of flavor. So that's the manifold, and you can ask, what do you get for the kind of gauge theory describing local moduli of the special holonomy manifold. So in this case, you get Hitchin system. So like the real honest Hitchin system, you get some choice of vector bundle and then some adjoint valued one comma zero form. I'm not going to bother giving a precise statement because you can state it more precisely than I can. So this thing I'll call close enough. I'll call it Waffle-Witten twist. And instead of a 1 comma 0 form, you have a 2 comma 0 form. Again, adjoint valued. Any guesses for what I should put here? Wild guess. It went 1, 2, a 3 comma 0 form. No. So in the context of F theory, you would get, so we're having an ADE singularity fibered over this Kähler threefold now. So it's not quite, I know what you're thinking of, but. I can explain why that is afterwards. How about this one? This is the one that Sakura and Miriam talked to you about, an adjoint valued one form. This is a real vector bundle. How about here? This is the case that I suppose you could have written down like a long time ago, although we couldn't find it in the literature. Write down a real vector bundle and then some adjoint valued self-dual two forms. Okay. What's that? Yes. This twist here is not the Waffle-Witten twist. So first off, I did not assume it was a Kähler surface. And second off, the twist is what I would have instead called Donaldson-Witten twist. But it's not quite a Donaldson-Witten twist of a 4D n equals 2 gauge theory. There's some extra degrees of freedom. That's where this fellow shows up from having a self-dual guy like that. So it's not just saying I want self-dual or anti-self-dual connections. It's slightly more than that. What's that? I'm thinking about it. So yes, it's in progress, but I don't know what to tell you right now. The answer is probably yes, but I don't know. Okay. Okay. So a nice thing about these things is you'll also notice there's a nice spectral geometry associated to that, as defined by the spectral equation for each of these things. You'll notice, by the way, that that spectral geometry is not typically even the same dimension as the local space you started with. That's a nice feature of these things because it makes it easier to study. So what do you get in each of these cases? You get cotangent of the curve. You get total space of the canonical over the surface in the Waffle-Witten case. Again, you get total space of this. You'll notice that each of these is, again, a kind of non-compact special holonomy manifold, but it's not the same dimension. Down here, you get T star M3. And any guesses which one I get here?
You get lambda 2 plus.
Absolutely. Yeah. So I'll just write it as self-dual bundles. So you see, I was talking about G2. You just didn't know it. So here it is. Here's a non-compact G2. Let me tell you, so we already heard a lot about the equations that govern the local geometry and how you kind of take a spectral cover and unfold it and all that. Let me tell you a little bit more about this case here. What are the equations? So I have... Well, I think what you want is you want a complete metric. I will be very loose with that. I'm not even going to demand it's a complete metric. So if you tell me that the metric has a problem, I'll just cut it out and talk about a little patch inside of it. So I'm not going to demand it's like positive curvature or anything like that. I'll be incredibly loose about that part as well. So that's okay. It just means that, you know, your local description is breaking down and there's more physics to be had. It's fine with me. Okay, so now what? What are the equations governing this thing? We take a covariant derivative with respect to the self-dual thing. It has to be 0. The other equation is f self-dual plus a thing I'll call the cross product. And that thing has to be 0. How did I define this cross product? I used the fact that my spectral geometry has a cross product built into it from the associative three form. So in other words, I get, so that I define this thing, I extend it. There's a map I can talk about like this, where I send like an AI and a BI, BJ into, all right, let's be physicists, epsilon IJK. AI, BJ. The reason why this thing is non-zero is because it's adjoint valued, so it's a bunch of matrices. So, you know, A times B is not the same as B times A. So this thing induces a corresponding thing where I kind of twist, if you like, by a G-bundle, as so. So these are the two equations that you have to study. And by the way, you can match this in the special case where this thing is also a Kalor surface. To something you've already that you would already see in that context, you can take, suppose if M4 is Kalor, there's a further decomposition we can do, which recovers things you probably already know from Bopha-Witten system, turns into a 2,0 form, 1,1 form, parallel to the Kalor form, however you chose it. There's precisely one self-dual 1,1 form I get to talk about. Like that, and then these equations collapse to something that looks like this. The 0,2 component of the curvature is 0, and with respect to the Kalor form, you have J, F plus. So this already made an appearance in the Socorro stuff, I think. So from these, you can get back out these. Okay. So that's the local geometry. Work in progress includes understanding better the moduli space associated to this and to match that onto statements about what the local spin 7 geometries will kind of deform into. In particular, the thing that's of interest to physicists is where you don't just have like a single codimension 4 singularity, but you allow further singularities and tracking what happens to those. A very convenient tool for doing that is via these gauge theory methods. So that's work in progress to study various codimension singularities, especially for the case of spin 7 and these local spin 7 geometries. As far as I can tell, this hasn't been totally worked out. So that's one of the other things we are doing at the moment. So I think I've run over my time. So the only things I will tell you about is, I'll just summarize quickly. What did I tell you about? I told you about how an F-theorist thinks a little bit about spin 7 and its potential uses. So in other words, T2 fibration, the lack of a globally defined T2 fibration is not fatal to the interpretation of F-theory. And in fact, it's a very interesting set of physical theories that if you gave me another hour, I would tell you about. But that's one application. And then I told you about some of the gauge theory tools we're using to kind of start studying some local properties of those geometries, very analogous to the things that Sakura and Miriam were mentioning in the case of local G2s and the corresponding gauge theory defined over a three manifold. So that's it. Thanks again. Yes? Oh, you need the microphone. There you go.
In the first part,
okay.
in this supergravity analysis. So if you take type 2B supergravity and you put metric Antons for S3, you allow three-form flux, and you solve killing span equations and try to solve the supergravity equations, do you see that you get an auxiliary sort of, if you combine the tau that you get there, you still have some sense in which there's a T2 vibration, right? Which
right.
is the axial dilaton.
Right.
So if you follow this through, do you see the condition for a spin 7 manifold, at least that the combined base plus fiber has Ricci 0? Does this come out? I mean, have so do a standard supergravity analysis of the setup with an S3 factor.
Yeah. So basically, we did check parts of it, and so the basic thing that you have is that there's a source term
sure.
over on the right hand side. So the standard Ricci flatness thing
yeah.
is almost satisfied for everybody except for things involving the Dilatino variation. So
mm-hmm.
the Dilatino variation does not quite vanish,
uh-huh.
and in fact, there's a right hand side to it, which is well, I'll probably mess it up, but there's the dilaton. This thing is definitely not zero in the case
mm-hmm.
we're talking
mm-hmm.
about. However, if you go back to what string theory tells you,
mm-hmm.
it doesn't have to be zero. There's a right-hand side to that equation. There's an h mu nu rho, h mu nu rho.
Mm-hmm.
That thing is on, and therefore that's the reason why we expect it to work. So we did check pieces of that.
Mm-hmm.
What else can I tell you? If you
it's just so there's a sense in which you can look at F theory supergravity solutions, right? And which hadn't really been done, but you can think of sort of make an ansatz. So here you want S3, and then you include all the fluxes.
Precisely. Yeah.
And then you ask killing spin equations, check all these supergravity conditions, and then you should see if this really is spin 7. That at the end of all this, there is modulo a profile of tau of the axial dilaton, which in the F theory context would be very holomorphically over the base. This wouldn't be the case here,
right?
Which is the situation
yeah, so,
I think
so,
that's writing
so
there. Modulo that equation here, but once you use these equations, it should boil down to a spin 7 condition. I would have thought. I mean, if there is a spin 7 solution of this type, that has to happen. So, for example, you can write down ADS solutions. You can have a long discussion about this. You can actually write down ADS solutions and include varying tau. And as long as you're careful what exactly the singularities are and what things they include into the say, central charges of the dual holographic CFTs, that's totally fine. It's surprising, but it works. So I'm wondering whether here something like that works too. Hmm?
I think the point is you solve it away from the points where the elliptic curve is collapsing.
Yes.
So the point is that the curvatures stay small away from where the several brains are localized. And that's the sense in which you can...
So the supergravity equations become Ricci curvature, for example, of the total space, including the axial dilaton vanishes, right? Or some generalization thereof. So I'm asking whether something like this you've checked or it's possible to...
Yeah, I mean, we did look at that. The other thing I can say we looked at is if you take the M theory limit. So
yes. mm-hmm.
it's something I didn't really have a whole lot of time to talk about, but there's a very
mm-hmm.
slick thing that happens with target space S3 with a flux through this.
Mm-hmm.
It turns out that if you look at the WZW model, which has target space S3, there is a T-dual description of this thing, which is S3 mod Zn. You take the large end limit of that thing, and you'll get out a two-sphere,
mm-hmm.
to leading order. And that's the sense in which you can start talking about a truncated M theory
mm-hmm.
That comes out. It's not completely unitary.
Uh-huh.
And so what we did is we also looked at whether we could get killing spinner equations on that thing.
Right. So in M theory, if you look at the same analysis with an S2 factor, you see that there's a spin 7.
Yeah, that one poses less problems. That's
mm-hmm.
basically a mild generalization of the thing that...
Yes.
One of the Beckers, right? Yeah, one of the Beckers.
Mm-hmm.
I don't remember which one. It was, all right.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, so I wanted to ask a bit more about how this, following on from that question about how the supersymmetry works when you go and look at it in 3,1 rather than 2,2 as far as the four-dimensional point of view goes. And it's to do with the question about the analytic continuation and so on.
Right.
And I think I mean, it looks to me as if it's would tie in with what's sometimes called in the literature fake supersymmetry, where you'd find when you went back to real variables, you'd find that you had something which looked like a Killing spinner, but it wasn't the usual Killing spinner equation, and that's sometimes found in cosmological solutions. Or to put differently, it would be a solution of not of the usual 2B theory, but of the 2B star theory, which has an F theory which is in 10,2 rather than in 11,1 signature.
2B star before we do the analytic continuation back, right? Or
well, it's a question about how you do the analytic continuation.
Because
we started thinking about the analytic continuation in going from 10,2 to 11,1, you'd have problems because you'd have to double the spinner
precisely. Representations. Yeah, so I can say a little bit more about the Killing spinners and what happens to them in 3,1. So where shall I write it? So you follow through this, and what you find is that there's a condition on your supercharges, which can be defined in both 2,2 and in 3,1. And it looks like, so let me adopt a 3,1 signature. So remember that H flux I had? Am I about to screw it up? Yeah, there you go. you get a condition like that. And in 3,1 signature, this causes the thing to just vanish. However, in 2,2 signature, there's something additional you can impose, which is that you can just say, I want a Majorana Weyl spinner in 2,2. And so this H-flux does not kill the supersymmetry there, but it would kill it, or what we would call the honest supersymmetry, not the fake one, in 3,1. So that's one of the things that's kind of work in progress, is to better understand what happens to the rest of the physical theory when you analytically continue from 3,1 to 2,2 and back and forth. So the only thing I told you about is it looks like there's this protected ground state, but I don't really know what happens to the rest of the spectrum. So I suspect that there's some very interesting phenomenology having to do with the fact that it's morally speaking like a 3D n equals 1 theory in terms of how much supersymmetry is. And in 3D n equals 1, there can be various holomorphy violations that take place. And so those probably have very interesting phenomenological signatures from the perspective of standard MSSM phenomenology. So for example, here's a standard superpotential coupling from MSSM, HUQU. You could now write down HD dagger QU. Totally insane from the perspective of N equals 1 MSSM, but it sounds like something like that probably does make sense for these models. So that's one of the things we're trying to figure out now, which is what is the kind of N equals half MSSM, if you like.